Hey everybody, this is Brian with a quick programming note before we start the show. This episode of the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour features a really fun conversation I had with filmmaker Andrew Keitlinger about his award-winning short film You Don't Know Bertha Constantine, as well as his first feature film Dust of War. Andrew is a really passionate and interesting guy, and I think you'll really enjoy his interview. Unfortunately though, this month I didn't have time to produce any new material to accompany Andrew's interview. Rather than put off releasing the episode any longer, I've decided to sandwich Andrew's interview between two previously released segments. So some of you might recognize the Five Worst Films of the Year and Fistfuls in the Flower Bed as originally having appeared in a Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour podcast that was released in December of 1976. Due to the age of the recording, there's an obvious and unavoidable difference in sound quality between Andrew's interview and other classic material. So I thank you in advance for bearing with me. If you're a longtime listener, I hope you'll still enjoy this previously released material. And if you're new to the show, then I guess it'll be new to you. As always, thanks for listening. Half past the hour, and we are coming out of our last break of the first half of the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. We've got a lot of ground to cover before the end of the show, so let's just jump right in. Well, here we are, at the end of another calendar year, my friends. And as longtime listeners know, every December I put together a humble little list I call the Best Five Films of the Year. Well, this year I did a little something different, and before I get into it, I feel like I need to provide a little disclaimer. Listen, you know I love cinema, but you also know that I hate how cinema is being corrupted by all the money-grubbing fat cats in Hollywood. Now, those fat cats have been at it for a while, but in my opinion, they have hit a new low this year. And for that reason, I unfortunately truly believe that this year of our Lord, 1976, will go down as the worst year in film history. That's why this year, instead of my typical Best Five Films of the Year, I present to you, as my own tiny little protest against those fat cats in Hollywood, the five worst films of 1976. Number 5. All the President's Men. Adapted from the 1974 nonfiction book of the same name, this snoozefest sleepily recounts the tedious events of the Watergate break-in, which nobody cares about anymore. That happened over 6 years ago. Memo to the fat cats in Hollywood. The reason we go to movies is because we like things that are made up, and we don't like to read. Save the book stories for the books, and save the newspaper stories for the newspapers, Warner Brothers. Number 4. Carrie. Here we go with yet another book adaptation. This one comes from a piece of trash written by a first-time author and no-name horror schlock jockey who calls himself Stephen King. King of what? Dumb, scary prom stories? It is unfortunate that this film exists, period, but probably the biggest shame of all is that it will certainly be a career killer for its young director, Brian De Palma. As for Mr. King, I hope he enjoyed getting his gross little book published, because there is almost no way it will ever happen again. Memo to the fat cats in Hollywood. Menstrual blood equals box office poison. Number 3. Network. The biggest problem with Network is that its premise is just too far-fetched. Director Sidney Lumet expects his viewers to believe that the human beings governing a television corporation, a news television corporation at that, would value ratings and profits more than a well-informed populace. Memo to the fat cats in Hollywood. The human spirit and intellectual curiosity will always triumph over laziness and propaganda. America knows this, and so does America's news corporations. Number 2. Taxi Driver. The fat cats in Hollywood just love to throw good money after bad, I guess. Case in point, Robert De Niro. Or should I say, Robert De Weirdo, because he's so weird in this movie. Fresh from 1974's disastrous The Godfather Part 2. This guy is just too much, Columbia Pictures. America likes its film protagonists to be well-rounded and well-adjusted, not weird. And am I really expected to shell out $2.13 for a movie ticket to watch some weirdo? By that I mean Robert De Niro, aka Robert De Weirdo, give himself a weird haircut? No thank you, fat cats in Hollywood. And by the way, fat cats in Hollywood, here's a memo for you. America doesn't like characters that are child prostitutes, even if they're only in supporting roles. It's unsettling. And finally, the number one worst film of 1976, Sylvester Stallone's Rocky. I've just got one little memo for the fat cats in Hollywood about Rocky, and that memo was this. Hey, fat cats, the protagonist is supposed to win in the end. I mean, come on. Now, before all the phone lines start flashing angrily, let me clarify something. I didn't hate every film that was released this year. After all, there's bound to be at least one gem amongst all the pieces of crap that were crapped into the litter boxes of America's movie houses by the fat cats in Hollywood. And that brings us to Brian Bieber's top film pick of 1976. Drumroll, please. Michael Anderson's Logan's Run, starring Michael York. Logan's Run tells the story of a futuristic utopia, where nearly all citizens live a carefree life of leisure in a safe, self-sustaining, contained environment. The only upsetting part is that when each citizen turns 30 years old, they're killed in an effort to avoid overpopulation. It sounds harsh, but really, is dying happy at 30 so bad when you stop to think about it? I mean, think about how we live now. The average person would be ecstatic to get 30 years worth of happiness stretched out over the course of a lifetime. So 30 good years all in a row? We should be so lucky. Anyway, Anderson's sci-fi epic was hands down my favorite film of 1976. And though it's too early to tell right now, it might just end up being my favorite film ever. The story is not needlessly complicated. Are you listening, All the President's Men? The costumes are very futuristic looking, and the special effects are as good as special effects will likely ever be. In fact, I will be shocked if Logan's Run does not go down as the biggest and best operatic science fiction movie of the 1970s, if not all time. So kudos to Mr. Anderson, kudos to Logan, and kudos to you if you had the good sense to catch this one before it left movie theaters, which are the only places movies will ever be available for us to watch. Alright, that's enough editorializing from me. Let's go ahead and open up the phone lines. What was your least favorite movie of the year? Give me a call. East of the Rockies, dial 1-800-00-GHOSTS. West of the Rockies, 1-800-1-HORSES. And we've already got someone on the line. Caller, go ahead. Here comes out and dance. She's stepping right on time. Here go the streetlights, bringing on the night. Here come the man.
The idea came to me because I really miss South Dakota. I was living in Boston, which is a great city, but I'm more of a, you know, I find that concrete jungles are very overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, they're cosmopolitan, but don't let them fool you, you know. Yeah. People there are very insular, in my opinion. I miss the open plains, you know, and I think the open plains is an image for just opportunity and the discovery of what else is out there. There's horizons. There's no horizons in the city. There's horizons in the plains. So it's, you know, the infinite opportunity of life. And I just miss that. I miss that feeling. And so I channeled it into my work. And I was on the treadmill one day and just had this, I don't know where it came from really, this vision of a woman, tugging her dead husband across the Badlands. And
this is Andrew Keitlinger. Andrew is an independent filmmaker who lives in Pierre, South Dakota. Right now he's talking about a short film, You Don't Know Bertha Constantine, about a middle-aged woman who resolves to honor her late husband's wish to be buried in the Badlands of South Dakota. Later, he'll be talking about his first feature-length film, Dust of War.
Yeah, and so it's a, you know, it's about the grieving process, the whole, you know, it's very unbelievable that a woman could cart a 200-pound man across the Badlands on a sled, but that's not the point. The point is, like, that grief, the point of You Don't Know Bertha Constantine is that grief can make you do extraordinary things. Mm. And it can make anything extraordinary make complete sense to that person who's in the grieving process. You know, you could decide that you want to go skydiving with your father's ashes or something and like sprue them out as you're pummeling to the earth. But for you, that makes complete sense because it's such a freeing experience. Whereas somebody else might be like, wow, that's really weird. There's that weird thing again, you know. But you're, you know, but you're cultivating your own emotions. You're like, this is what I want to do with. This is what I want to do. This is what feels right. And so, Birth of Constantine is ultimately about what feels right in doing it. And obviously, it stemmed from my mother's death. It was very like all the work that I did after my mother's death in terms of film was very much rooted in the whole grief process. How can I? Because I'm not a big crier. I don't cry like, ooh, you know, I didn't need to go to counseling. I wasn't like moping around, you know, the house and things like that. Or, you know, so what I did is I just channeled it into my work, you know, or whatever I did. And I started this fascination with death. You know, I wrote my government thesis was about suicide bombers, which I find fascinating. Someday I hope to make a movie about suicide bombers. But anyway, so Birth of Constantine just kind of came out of, you know, my grief, my mother. So it was a very cathartic experience for me, and also my, you know, my love for South Dakota. So I combined the two and I wrote the script. The script was really well liked by the professors there. And it won a couple of awards, the script did, which was great. And then and I think the script was very much, I kind of wrote it like a Sam Peckinpah movie. Like Sam Peckinpah, like one of my favorite movies is Straw Dogs. And I kind of had this like 70s thing. Like I love 70s cinema. And I think it influences me the most. Like the camera work, the editing, 70s cinema for me is just very visceral. It's more realistic than what we have today. So that's kind of something that I wanted to put into this movie. Visually speaking, I didn't really get that Sam Peckinpah feel that I was going for. With Dust of War, I did. For me, visually, as an artist, Bertha was more of a crash course on how to handle budget, you know, overproduction, actors, a crew, you know, a legitimate crew, you know, and egos in a crew and, you know, catering, all those things like that, you know, how to just balance the human aspect of a film production as opposed to the creative side. But what it did is it eventually prepared me to handle Dust of War, which was, you know, an apocalyptic event in terms of art. I was like, oh, so. I mean, Dust of War was supposed to be this throwback to the 80s and 90s, sort of like that type of filmmaking, even with some 70s thrown in, but just like Indiana Jones, Willow, Conan the Barbarian, Mad Max, all those good things.
There's something about him. Makes people follow.
I mean, wanted the story to be as simple as possible. You know, it's about a lone warrior who has to save a girl who's fated as the savior of humanity, and everybody wants a piece of her.
This is the apocalypse, but the world didn't end.
It takes a lot of faith to do what you do, to believe in her.
We'll need a ride.
Why are you doing this?
You bring something very powerful to the table. The girl, you know her secret. And tell me what it is, or I'll slaughter your friends.
We're not leaving anybody.
So yeah, it's basically, you know, guy must save girl because girl's being chased by bad guy movie. And we wanted it to be that simple because we knew our budget, you know, we had such a low budget. And I won't throw the number out right now. I'd rather not. Let's say it was under $1 million and we knew the budget was so low that we wanted the movie to be character based. We wanted it to be about the characters and less about the action because we knew that we can't afford to do high explosives and all this action. So if you make our audience fall in love with these characters, then we've successfully made the movie. So it was always supposed to be a character-driven post-apocalyptic movie. It's an artsy post-apocalyptic movie in the end. Because I think we want this to end up as a film festival movie. Because I think it's a fun movie. I think one of the keywords I used going into production was oppressive. Mm-hmm. Another keyword was unpretentious. I didn't want to go in saying we're going to make an art film. I wanted to go in saying we're just going to make a movie that audiences will enjoy. And then I think the art just kind of evolved from the process of making the film, you know, and the environment and the actors. But I wanted to be unpretentious. I wanted to send a movie to festivals that audiences, after going and seeing a depressing movie with Paul Giamatti trying to kill himself or something, which he does, you know, I'm sure he'd rock at it and win an Oscar, but that they could go to another theater and see Dust of War and be like, that was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. That was great. It was artful, but it was great. It was fun. You know, we went into this, we were dead serious. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to make this as good as possible. And I think the best compliment I got from an executive in LA when he saw the trailer was, that does not look like it was made for under $1 million, which I think is the best. Because as a director, the way that I will continue getting a job, because I won't benefit from this movie financially.
Yeah.
What I'll benefit from is that somebody will say, you can do that for under $1 million. Yeah. I'd love to see what you can do with 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then in my job, I think director, the best thing directors can do is deliver under budget, under schedule, and put as much on the screen as possible.
I guess I'm posing this as a question, but it's a loaded question, but I feel like the art almost always benefits from the artist being hungry for success. Like, if they don't, you know, if you had been given an unlimited budget to make this movie, you know, as your first feature, then I just have this feeling that it, just based on what you've said and from seeing the work, that it maybe wouldn't have been as good, it could have look slicker or something.
Completely accurate. Yeah. Absolutely, completely. I mean, like I told you on Bertha, a budget was bloated. We had too much money to work with, and I think that it. And I said I lost control because of it. On Dust of War, I never felt like I lost control. And also, I knew the how much we had. Like, there were days, 15 days into it, we almost couldn't afford Tony Todd because my producer said, you know, we got to make the decision. We get Tony for this amount of money, then we have to cut this in the car chase, you know.
Mm.
And we decided that it was important to have a Tony Todd in it. That the car chase, you know, wasn't the point of the movie. The point of the movie was the characters, and we wanted an actor who could convey that. So, I think it's shoot smart, produce smart, you know, just make film smart. And knowing, I mean, yeah, I remember our producer and I saying, if we had $1 million, it'd probably be too much, and we probably would get out of hand. So we shot with nothing, and you talk about the artist being hungry. I mean, God, I'm starving. You know, I haven't eaten yet today. Where's my food? You know, but I think, you know, the people we hired, our cinematographer was hungry, our producer was hungry. He also, you know, the lead actor Stephen Luke, hungry. You know, he did everything in that movie. You know, he risked his life. You know, we shot the most dangerous stunt of the movie last, so in case he died, we had everything in the can. You can always tell a hungry artist, and I don't mean hungry as in like poor and starving, even though that's usually what they are, but one that loves the craft so much that they want to put in the blood, sweat, and tears to reach that point. And I think that, you know, a director like, you know, Steven Spielberg is the wunderkind of how he got into Hollywood and things, but there is a guy that was hungry for success, and I don't think he's abused. Like, he didn't become famous and all of a sudden just be like, okay, great. Like, he's still a director that shoots smart, produces smart, and makes films smart. I think it's all about perception. You know, as you said, you thought that, you know, you enjoyed Bertha. And I hope, I mean, I think Bertha is a success fundamentally because a lot of people came up and said to me, like, that's how my journey of grief was. And for me, that is success. That is a successful piece of art because, oh, and, you know, that's great. So personally, as an artist, as a director, I could have done better. But if somebody comes up to me and says, that movie made me think about my father, and, you know, when he was still alive and things like that, and if it made them cry, and it's hard to argue. Exactly. This weapon at his side, he flashes it with pride before his legion. And you feel it real.
to Papa. Come see your Papa. If you need a pacifier.
Actually kind of hated it, man. I mean, that whole world they lived in was so gross and artificial. And knowing that you were going to be killed for no good reason just because you coasted through your allotted years to live, what kind of life would that be?
Listen, I hear you, caller, but what if maybe they didn't do it to you for some reason? I mean, say you're living in the Logan's Run world, and your 30th birthday comes and goes, but maybe no one notices. And then you're 31, and then you're 35. And then 40 and 50, and what if you just got to keep living in that happy, easy world, and before long you've lived out a whole lifetime there? Safe and protected and not ever having to know what it's like to be hurt or to worry?
Are you talking about the movie still?
Here, let me tell you about something. My grandfather lost his right finger working in the Homestead Mine in Leeds, South Dakota. It was smashed between two rocks somehow, I think. After it healed, a little nub of bone poked out from the round and shiny tip.
I guess I don't really get where you're going.
My grandpa worked the graveyard shift. On the night his finger was smashed, he came home early. He couldn't sleep from the pain, so he woke his four kids and assembled them in the kitchen. With a flourish, he pulled the bandage from his hand and wagged the pulpy tip of his finger at his groggy children. "What do you think of that?" he laughed. My grandfather walked the way men walk after they've spent their lives working hard. Shoulders rounded, each step an all-out assault against the ground. My father inherited my grandfather's work ethic, as well as the walk that goes along with it. It's a beautiful walk. I walk the way a man walks when he's had it easy. My steps are thoughtless. I take them like they're owed to me. I want to walk like my grandfather, but I don't want any hard times. I want to leave a mark, but I want to keep my fingers. When my grandfather was the age I am now, he had a wife and four kids. They lived in a home built by his father. My great-grandfather wasn't an architect. None of the angles in the house are quite 90 degrees, but it still stands just fine. When my grandfather was the age I am now, he was already down to 9.5 fingers. I worry about anything, about most things. Sometimes it makes my stomach hurt. I think about the acid churning down there, about what it must be doing to my insides. It gives me something more to worry about. When my grandfather died, we cremated him. We dropped him by the fistful into his flower beds. There was a breeze as I opened my hand, and I worried that some of the grains would blow into the cuffs of my jeans, my socks, my shoes. I've only been to the beach twice in my life, but I know how the sand creeps into your clothes and hides. Afterward, a thin layer of his dust filled the creases of my palms and the bends of my fingers. I wanted to wash my hands. Was that allowed? Was it better or worse than just brushing my hands together, as if I was dismissing him like a finished chore? I didn't know the etiquette, so I made a joke out of it, chuckled nervously with my aunt, and rinsed that small part of him down the drain. I think about my grandfather, hunched and tough-skinned and smashed up. Whether you crumble under the weight of things, or you dissolve from the inside out, the result is the same. But it seems like there's slightly more dignity in weathered skin, bent backs, and missing digits. At least it looks like you put up a fight. Listen, caller, I know that we've all got to die. I know that we can't take our 30 good years all at once, all in a row. I just want to die while I'm still beautiful. And first, I've just got to get beautiful.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ah, ah, ah.
Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour is produced by suppressing apprehension and indulging narcissism. In this episode, you heard music from Bob Seger's classic album, Night Leaves, and you heard stories from me that I will not be comfortable discussing with you at any length in person. You can watch the official trailer for Andrew Keitlinger's Dust of War at dustofwarmovie.com. And you can keep abreast of post-production and release news by liking Dust of War on Facebook. If you're interested in hearing more about Andrew's background and filmmaking process, subscribe to the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour in iTunes. In the not-too-distant future, I will release a bonus podcast featuring a significantly less abridged version of our conversation. If you liked anything you heard in this episode, please go to ghostsandhorses.com, where you will find material of a similar quality. This has been the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. Thank you for listening. Caller, go ahead. Caller, go ahead. Caller, you can go ahead now. Caller?